Welcome to the Powercast with Charlie Johnson. I'm one of the world's leading fitness and transformation coaches. I'm going to be providing you with the tools to build your ultimate body and mind.
It's an absolute pleasure today to have a man I've looked up to for a long time. He's an absolute genius when it comes to muscle building and programming. It's Mr. Scott Stevenson, all the way over from North America. How are you doing?
North America, I like that, yeah.
North American
continent. Well, I'm not in Canada, I'm not in Mexico, but yeah, in sunny Florida. I'm good, man, I'm good. You were just here, Houston.
Yeah, I was just over in Houston and I got held up in the storm and bits and pieces. So that did make it a little bit problematic getting back to the UK. So wasn't quite an ideal timing in that respect, I guess, with the weather. But there we go. Mm-hmm. However, the trip to the US was awesome. So absolutely loved it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. A quick story. It's kind of funny. So I was coming back from Pittsburgh. I actually competed. So I was really tired. I'm coming back. And we sat in our plane, there was something broken that they couldn't fix. We sat there for 2 hours. People were getting really riled up, pissed off. Then they took us off the plane. They reboarded us on another plane. We had to zip across the airport when we started flying in. And the interesting thing was, this was just like one of those sort of Zen type of moments that I don't know if everyone else appreciated, but I really thought it was awesome. It was so annoying to so many people. When we got on this new plane, we're flying in, and as it turned out, there was bad weather that was causing them to reroute planes away from Tampa. So yeah. Had we not had that initial delay, we would have had to been rerouted to Orlando, which is like an hour or so away, and landed there, and then probably haven't either spent the night or taken a car or something like that. So those 2 hours saved us like a day's worth of delay. And no one was like, no one even recognized that, but it was just like, this was like, I was like, that's awesome. So you never know. It's one of those things. You never know when something shitty happens that it can actually be a good thing. So
on that note as well, to be honest, like our flight was canceled. So we got moved back a day. And like, for me, I was like, oh, it's frustrating. I'd rather that happened than the plane crash. So if you think about it in hindsight of like issues, I think
exactly.
Probably things out of proportion a little bit. It's not literally life or death if you go a day later.
You probably got to go train at the gym you were there at in Houston.
Enjoy some more American food as well.
Yeah. Like you got another memory out of the deal. So it's not too bad, really.
Exactly. So today we're obviously going to test through your muscle building secrets, how you've obviously helped your clients grow a huge amount of muscle over the years and also yourself as well. So I'm fascinated with some of your systems in terms of what you do with your own like fortitude training. Just to give someone a bit of a background, like what is it you do, Scott, and like your education backgrounds? I think you've got quite a varied history.
Yeah, I mean, I've done this so many times. I use sort of the people ask me, like, what do you do? Because they can't quite figure out from the context conversation. I sometimes tell people I'm a purveyor of bodybuilding brain candy. So people just like to hear me kind of talk about sciencey types of things and ramble on. But I'm just like a meathead. I grew up like reading Muscle and Fitness when I was a kid. I just loved the gym. I had immediate attraction to it. I actually wanted to train with weights long before my mom would actually let me do it. So I finally started when I was 11. So I've been at it for a while now. And I've owned a gym. I'm actually a licensed acupuncturist now. So I wanted to be able to sort of treat people and have a medical angle as well. I was a college professor for a few years. So I went through and earned a PhD so I could, just because I'm a eager beaver for information.
What was your PhD in, Scott, for anyone who doesn't know?
Exercise physiology. Yeah. Muscle biology kind of was the focus. It was all about actually making muscle grow. We did a lot of biopsies, work with people with spinal cord injury, work with older folks. I did a creatine study for my dissertation. So we used MRI and some pretty cool training methodology that actually you can't even really do unless you have the particular lab equipment, but it's sort of an almost inhumane way to train muscle to make it grow really rapidly. So, yeah, it was all about muscle growth. My advisor has passed on now. I dedicated the Fortitude Training book to him, which is kind of a meathead. It's kind of a muscle head from Platehead is what he called himself, Ohio. But he's an absolute genius, and he created a lot of the perspective that I have now where you sort of step back and look at the big picture, just sort of, you know, kind of a regular person's way. You met those people that are they're kind of like, well, we started talking about Zen Buddhism, but sort of like a Buddha at the gas pump. You meet someone, you're like, you know, that person has got this really sort of simplistic but clear way of seeing things. And Dudley would do that. And this is sort of, I've kind of carried this on, and I've seen it in his other students too, some that I went to school with, of stepping back and looking at all the intricacies that people can get lost with the science and say, okay, so what the hell is really going on here? Like, what's the bottom line? what can we make of this? And he would just literally blow people's minds with these very simple questions that you would think someone who'd spent 20 years studying a particular topic could answer like that, but they've never looked back at the forest from the trees in the way that he did. So that's what I try to do and sort of link together for people out there just trying to gain muscle or be fit or what have you, some of the science and the practical application. So I'm sort of an intermediary. I translate the science and write the books, Fortitude Training, and my Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book as well. So just trying to help people. It's the bottom line. Do some, give back to what's given to me.
That's what I think is so fascinating about you, though, is because you've got the science reference points behind everything you do, and the anecdotal evidence of obviously your own physique and the clients you work with, whereas you generally only tend to get someone who's more of like a bookworm who hasn't got any anecdotal experience, or the other end of the spectrum where it's more of like a gym bro who doesn't really understand science, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, I know tons of brilliant people who probably could do a really good job training people if that was their focus, but do you even lift really applies to those folks? And there's so much that can be had from actually getting there and doing it. I remember when I was long time ago when I was first in graduate school and I had taken anatomy and physiology and I was teaching anatomy and physiology. So I had to know it at a very, very deep level. Origin, insertion, action, nerve, blood supply, those sorts of things. And I'd be in the gym with this information fresh in my head. I'm like, this is really quite amazing because I know exactly which muscle is involved here. I could figure out that my peroneus longus muscle was what was getting tight, and that's what's causing a problem when I'm trying to train the medial gastrocnemius and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that I was able to really see the value in connecting all that intricate scientific information, which we all live in the same universe. It's not as if there's a universe in the ivory tower where the scientists, you know, gather the information. It just kind of trickles down there, you know, some magical way. It's the same universe that's explored in scientific experiments. Sorry about my dogs there.
That's right.
Protecting us for someone. That is at play in the gym. It's the same friggin' thing. The gym's a lab, just the same as the way a lab is a lab. So all that information, it's like it's all part of one giant network. And if you can see those connections, it's really pretty cool. So I was always fascinated by that, to be able to bring those things together, sort of the in the trenches and the scientific information, see where those two jive and where did they not jive.
So like the connecting the dots sort of principle.
Yeah, basically. And there's so much, I mean, it's so, one of the things I get asked a lot when I do podcasts is like, how can people look into the scientific literature and actually make sense of that? And we get so discombobulated by that information. People look and they see, you know, all these numbers with means and standard deviations, and it's information that they can actually, if they just use some common sense, figure out whether it applies to them or not. Like, who are the subjects? Most exercise science resistance training studies were done with newbies, essentially untrained people. And
that's my big thing with studies as well, particularly like supplement studies, is like you have to think of who is the study conducted on and are they relevant to you? Because if you're like an elite level athlete, chances are the individuals involved are nothing like you.
Yeah, right. So that's external validity or ecological validity. Does it actually apply to you or the people you work with as a coach in any way, shape, or form? You want to use untrained people because you get a massive training effect. So you at least, it's nice to do a training study. And sometimes you'll see this where there's no gains in either group. And it always boggles. It's one of my favorite things where they say, well, supplement X did not improve muscle mass or strength gains during this 8-week period of training. But sometimes the training won't even improve those things very much. Or if it did tremendously or hardly at all. And that's a lot of times in trained groups. But when you step back and look at what actually happened, anyone of average or even below average intelligence can see very basic things from these studies. If you just learn to not kind of be intimidated by the information, it's people listening probably have parents. My mom is pretty good at this now, but I know lots of people who literally, they look at a computer and they just sort of get like, they don't know what to do with it. Like, how do I work this crazy thing? Like there's all this keys and the mouse and what have you. It's like, it's just like a child. You take your mouse and you click it what you want. Like, give me this. Click, click, click. And you think of it, like, literally the thought process that goes on in the course of using basic operating systems is very simple on computers. And the same thing applies really to the science. Okay, you know, I don't know what the hell they were doing when they used this cryostat to freeze this muscle and all this kind of flim-flam, but, you know, look, they didn't really increase the muscle fiber size very much here, or it increased tremendously so, or, you know, these people just, they've never trained before. If you look back at the very basics and the overview of the study, you can figure out so many things. So I'm able to do that a little bit better because I've been trained formally to do that, and I've done research, so I can actually do that, hopefully a little bit better than the average person having a PhD. So that's where I think I can really help folks the most.
On that note, obviously going to a bit more of a specific question, obviously your programming, from my understanding, combines both factors, but what do you think is a bigger influence on muscle growth and hypertrophy, volume or intensity in terms of like loading?
Effort. I'm gonna go with a C. Like, you intensity, you mean like percent one rep max?
Yeah. Intensity and effort, so like RPE, like rate of perceived exertion.
Yeah. Because sometimes people will formally say intensity is, you know, your intensity was 80% of one rep max. It's effort in my mind. And I know this just because this is something I've seen in over the years. The people who are willing to basically push themselves to the point where they're bleeding or they're losing bodily fluids in some other way, who really, really want to push it in the gym, are the ones that will make the most progress, who are really dedicated and devoted to doing that and are willing to do that. It's a really bizarre thing to go and pick up a load and repeatedly as we do. It's not very comfortable. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. When I lived in Germany, I had a host family one of the times I was over there, and the husband, the man of the house, used to always just laugh at me. He's like, "Are you going to go do this again, huh? Just go like that." And he was so right. And so I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go like aimlessly.
You think about it logically, it's a bit retarded, really.
It's absolutely retarded, and it hurts. You know, it's there's reasons probably for why we do this from an evolutionary perspective. But so it's sort of a bizarre thing. And it's the willingness to, I think, continue to progress and push oneself. And that can be done. And I've seen this with fortitude training. For, so I have three volume tiers in the program. And one of the most advanced trainees ever to use that, someone who, he got second at the Canadian Nationals. No, actually won his class at the Canadian Nationals, but he didn't get a pro card because they only give out one to the overall winner. So if he had been competing at the equivalent level in the States, he'd have been a pro many years ago. He was a professional wrestler. And I know, just knowing his mentality, I'd worked with him before, that he's a friggin' maniac. he can only do tier one. Because he was making every set a death set, and he grew tremendously, and he was willing to eat. All these things sort of fit into sort of a psychological profile. So on the other hand, if you look at the research literature, and if you sort of tie together some pieces with this quote unquote volume is the driver of muscle growth idea, you look at some of the studies that have been done, they put in the methodologies that the student or the subjects took their sets to failure. So they went as hard as they possibly could until they actually felt that they were unable to complete another rep with good form as defined in the study. But there's also a good bit of research now showing that when people are asked to assess either the weight they could use or even during the course of a set, how many reps in reserve do you have? How many reps could you do? They will grossly underestimate this. To the point, like, well, you know, I think I'm just about done. I got two more, and they could actually do 8 or 10 more in many cases. You've probably seen that with beginners. You can take beginners through, once you get them, you don't do this the first session because they'll just get so sore they'll never want to come back. But you just say, okay, give me three more, you know, give me five more. And that's just, if someone's really pushed to the brink of true failure, that's just an impossibility. It doesn't happen. So if you look at some, like the study, it just kind of comes up because it was just all over the social media not too long ago, was one of Brad Schoenfeld's studies where they were doing a very high volume. And if you read through the exercises they were doing with the rest intervals, it would have hospitalized me if I tried to train in that way. I mean, I would have made it, you know, it would have been absolutely pitiful in terms of the loads I could use. But this is the type of thing I was sort of referring to earlier about actually reading the literature and like just downloading the paper. Many of them are free now and saying, okay, this is what they did. Could I actually do four sets or five sets of squats in the 8 to 12 rep range to failure with 60 or 90 seconds rest in between, and then move to a leg press, and then move to a bent over row, and then move to a lat pull down, et cetera, and do that, maintain that pace for an hour and 15 minutes, and come back and do that 2 days later. And 2 days later, those people had to have been sandbagging. But for them, that's, yeah. So, and it's funny, I haven't seen anyone mention this, but it's interesting that there's, researchers are people too. And there's a conundrum here in trying to create these training studies, because basically if you're an editor, let's say you receive a paper and you're going to look through it and say, okay, so how do they train these people? And how did they standardize their training stimulus? Well, the easiest way to standardize this is they took their sets to failure. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. There's nothing left. It wasn't like, they took them to a RPE of 8 out of 10, or they left one or two reps in the tank, reps in reserve or what have you. They could just take it to failure because that's black and white and that's beyond question. So that's literally kind of become the standard. If you enter if you put a study in, imagine a researcher and they're saying, well, we had our subjects, hold up a little bit on all but like the last set or what have you, that ends up putting a lot of wishy-washiness. It creates a nebulous training stimulus because you don't really know how hard they pushed, because that now you've entered into subjectivity, the pain perception, all those things has basically somewhat become an exercise psychology experiment, because it's the training stimulus is relative to how hard the person could push and how they assess their reps in reserve, as opposed to black and white, they took all their sets to failure.
Yeah, it's very much open to interpretation, isn't it?
Yeah, so you just have to. I'm going to just have to take all my sets to failure. That's just what we'll tell them. But that, if you look at the literature, we know that quote unquote failure, and someone who's a newbie, who's just a beginner with training, is a nebulous thing, because it probably changes over time, and that's been demonstrated as well. That people who are more advanced have do a better job of estimating their reps in reserve when they actually are forced to carry out a set to true failure where they can't continue to move the weight.
On that note of true failure then, Scott, would you recommend from a muscle building perspective, you should take all sets to failure?
I don't do that in fortitude training. If your volume is low, I mean, if you're just doing like maybe one or two sets per workout, like true working sets, then that's possible. The thing that I've noticed, and this is my in the trenches sort of experience, is that if you leave one or two reps in reserve in the course of an exercise and just stop the set there, compared to taking that same set, the same load, and going literally to where you reach a failure point, or like the next, you're absolutely certain the next rep is not going to happen, the sort of the inroads to your recovery and the extent to which that impacts your ability to train hard and lift heavier loads thereafter is substantially different. So those failure sets, they just whack you in a way that leaving one or two reps in reserve does not. But there's logic to leaving one or two reps in reserve. You can look at this whole idea of effective reps is somewhat wishy-washy. It's based on EMG data from isometric contractions. There's some logic to it. It makes sense. Like, if you got a 10 rep max and you're only doing 5 reps, probably none of those reps are going to create a stimulus because the effort level was so low. There's a little bit of research looking into that. But you're still, if you leave one or two reps in reserve, you still created a pretty strong stimulus. And if you do, let's say, 5 sets and you leave one or two reps in the tank on each of those, you've created a training stimulus from that. As long as you're literally able to, you're training hard and you're really able to truly assess what one or two reps in reserve is from a true failure point.
So it's quite over the right volume then as well with that.
Yeah. So, and everyone's different. Like there's so much variability. This is one of my big topics is how hard people can train. Have you ever done DC training, dog crap training?
Yeah, I did like a derivative of that using push pull legs for a long time. And I found it worked well. However, certain body parts were getting a little bit neglected, like namely shoulders and arms. And also my CNS was just getting whacked from doing like heavy movements, was just writing me off for days on end.
Yeah, those are tough. And the reason I brought it up was the Widowmakers.
Yeah.
And the idea behind that widowmaker is like literally that if you were married, you would be making your wife into a widow because you're going to kill yourself. And someone's watching that set from the outside, like, holy shit, this guy has a death wish. So that is like a true failure set. And I actually have people shy away in fortitude training from doing those widowmakers where you do a near failure rep and you rest, and a near failure rep and rest, because all those near failure reps, those just accrue and they end up just knocking you on your ass.
Yeah. If anyone's not sure what a widowmaker is, it's the same as a rest pause set, essentially, isn't it, Scott?
Not really. The rest pause set, like a DC rest pause set or a cluster set in general, muscle rounds a kind of cluster set.
Yeah.
A rest pause set and DC training is a kind of cluster set. You actually do some lifting and then you take a break, you put the weight down and you rest completely and recover, and you pick it back up. The widowmaker is one where you don't rack the weight. You keep the weight in your hand, or you keep the bar on your back, or wherever it may be, and you try to extend the set, manage the set to get as many reps as you possibly can, and extend it as long as you can. To basically, it looks like you are just trying to do yourself in.
So if you're going until you can't go anymore.
Yeah, and it becomes an art form. You can get really good at it. Like, so let's say you want to get 20 reps on a back squat. You know, a strategy would be like, okay, you pick your weight. I'm going to do about 12 reps and then I'll stop, keep the bar in the back. There's no racking. There's no resting there. And you take 4 or 5 deep breaths, then do 2 or 3 more breaths, then do a single rep. And if you are so motivated and if you said, I use this analogy all the time, my entire family and all my best friends are hanging above a pit of molten lava. And if I don't get 20 reps, they're all going to get dropped into that, they're going to die. My whole life's going to, everyone's going to be gone. Then you're going to keep that bar on your back, and you're going to spend 20 or 30 seconds, wobbling around, trying to stay conscious, and you're going to get those reps. And you've seen people do like 100 rep sets. If someone wants to see an amazing set, look up Sarge's 100, or I think he got 98 reps with body weight. It's an old video on, Marundi was the guy's last name. I can't remember his first name. It was a power or a strong man. I think it's Jesse. But he does. This guy does body weight about 2 1/4 for 98 reps. Jeez. And it's like a 10-minute set. It's like what Platts was renowned to do. You set the kitchen timer and just squat for 10 minutes. That's just mind-boggling. That will just – you don't do sets like that. That's it. Like you don't go home. You just lie there and hope you don't die on the gym floor at first. So, but back to failure, there is something because, and I always use this. I say this a good bit too. Like sometimes what I have done in the past in many ways is, in order to know where the line is, I try to step over it. So I've used myself sort of as a lab rat and done things knowingly that, probably weren't going to be the best outcome, but I wanted to be certain of that. So I've trained in the shows using the highest volume tier on fortitude training, knowing there's probably too much, just to sort of see, if I would actually adapt in those last few weeks of the show to be able to handle it. Turned out I was right in the first place. So when it comes to failure training, pushing yourself to a true failure and doing that repeatedly, you're learning how to break through those mental barriers. So that I think is an important thing. Over the course of time, I would imagine that someone, and this is part of probably their psychological makeup, but someone who's doing, let's say you've got just two scenarios, two twins or what have you, and they're each doing 3 sets of exercises in general, and one twin just leaves 1 or 2 reps in reserve on those 3 sets. And the other twin does the same on the first 2 sets, but the third set's always a failure set. Well, he really tests him or herself. Over the course of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years, that twin who's been doing those failure reps is probably going to develop a little bit. They're going to develop a different hardening of their mindset because they're taking those reps to failure. They're pushing in a way that the other twin hadn't been doing. And also so when they're thinking, I got 1 or 2 reps in reserve, if you've never actually gone to failure, it's sort of an extreme example, then how do you know? You have to have gone to failure to some degree.
Yeah, you don't know where the ceiling is or the floor.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to test that, and you can move it over time as you get better and more capable of training hard. Plus, it helps programmatically too in various contexts, just to kind of know, like, this is how many reps I actually can get. So sometimes you'll surprise yourself, so you can move things up. So I think a failure set, when done safely and in the right amount, and that depends on the person, has utility both just from knowing how much to progress your sets, your loads over time, and as well as just sort of hardening the mindset and learning how to train hard.
Do you think there's a lot to be said about maybe matching training style and setup to the mentality of the individual? Because if you had, say, some people, for example, don't have the mental fortitude to maybe push themselves to those extremes, then that sort of, like, obviously, like a low volume progressive overload approach probably wouldn't be optimal.
Absolutely. If some people just don't want to do, they just don't like to train that way. I had another, speaking of Widowmakers, I told this story before. I had a guy who was one of the trainers at my gym, and he was wanting to put on a bunch of mass. And so, and I was just starting up a fortitude training blast. We trained lower body. I did my Widowmaker and, you know, got done, kind of crawled out from under the bar and was kind of heaving. And I'm like, okay, how much weight do you want? And he just looked at me and said, I don't want to do that. I'm not doing that. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, I don't want to train this way. That's just too much. I'm not doing it. And I'm like, that was perfect. Cause all he would have probably done is like tried to do some Widowmakers and he would have been frustrated. It never would have worked out for him. It was not, did not fit with his mindset. He wanted to go and get a nice pump, check himself out in the mirror more so, maybe look at the women in the gym. And so he was someone, for instance, who doesn't want to push to that sort of mind bending point of failure where you're, you know, you're seeing God and you're having a conversation about the afterlife. his volume is going to be something that to some degree will be able to make up for the lack of effort for him. So he might end up doing, he might be someone who progresses really well because he prefers to stay in the gym a little bit longer. He likes to keep the pump going. He likes to leave three or four, one or two reps in the tank. Maybe have a few hard sets, and he doesn't want to have the logbook. He doesn't want to progress. So that's where volume would be more important for someone like that, because you got to counterbalance the lack of effort.
Would you ever, like, say something like, instance, would you ever recommend doing like a two-a-day training split with anyone like that? Is that something you've trialed with anyone in the past to like bring up lagging body parts perhaps?
I don't, maybe something small.
Yeah.
I try to look at lagging body parts. I actually have a YouTube video people can go and maybe you can link it here when we get done.
Yeah, I'll drop in the description for anyone to have a look. I'll check it out.
Yeah, there's something to say. I mean, for the way that my training system, you need the recovery. Fortitude training is only a four-day-a-week program in its sort of most basic form. There's even a three-day version. DC training, you know, the basic two-way split was three times a week because you need that recovery time in between. But if you're someone who, you know, is like you said, is not willing to push that much and they like going into the gym and they feel recovered and they can get away with that, then yeah, that could definitely happen. But the big picture of a lagging body part is figure out why is it lagging to the best of your ability.
Normally training technique, I would take a hint at.
Yeah, it could be the training. You don't have a good mind muscle connection. Maybe the muscle is always sore. It's constantly sore. It's never really getting fully recovered. And that can happen. I've noticed that in myself. It's sort of been my newest hobby horse, looking at muscle damage. And there's some interesting research there.
An interpretation of when you should go back to, like, recently I've been struggling a little bit, say for example, my lower body recovering. And it's been, I've started adding in more unilateral work, which I think has increased the muscle damage from that. What's your point where you think is the cutoff where you're not good to go back in and train again? Is the point where if you've just got inflammation, there's still slightly sore to touch, or like your quads, for example, would you just go with how you feel, or is there anything that anyone could take home as more of like a concise answer?
Yeah, that's the most concise sort of objective way is to use a logbook and see how well you're progressing.
Mm.
See if you're able to improve performance in some way, shape, or form. So you don't necessarily have to be doing like heavy stuff, like, you know, sets of 6 to 8 and trying to progress in that way. It can be you're doing higher rep work and you're seeing some increase in the number of reps you're getting with a lower load or what have you. But that will sort of tell you over time, literally, and this is a topic that we had Brad Schoenfeld on another podcast I used to do, and we asked him this, and it's amazing to me. This is another big picture thing that I'm just I can't imagine why people haven't done these analyses, because the data are there. Is there are some studies that are showing that if you look at strength or heavy loading performance, like, you know, 6 to 8 rep max, those sorts of things, that tracks pretty well with increases in muscle mass or fat-free mass. So the people who get the strongest on those heavy loading or the greatest 1RM, 1 rep max increases are the people who tend to get the most muscle size, show the greatest gains in muscle mass overall. But we also know that the lighter loading training will increase muscle size as well. So that's when people are doing like 30, 50, 60% of 1 rep max. Sometimes these studies are done with blood flow restriction. And those researchers can go back and look at that data and say, okay, in these subjects who trained one leg that way or both legs that way, and they increase muscle size, if we look at the loads they used over the course of time, even though they weren't that heavy because they're doing like 30 rep sets, does the increased performance that they achieved over the course of that training period predict the amount of muscle mass they got? My guess would be yes. There's several studies that have actually demonstrated the high versus low load thing. You may have talked about that here on the podcast. You know, it's one of the aspects that's actually in fortitude training, is that you can put on muscle mass with heavy training or with lighter training, as long as you're training really, really hard.
See, I personally find it more so with lower body that my legs seem to respond better to slightly higher rep ranges, like an all-out failure set for, say, for example, a leg press at 25, 30 reps, I find I get a lot more from than a heavy set of 6 to 8, for example.
Yeah, that's very, very common. Most people find that to be the case. It makes sense for various ways. But so in your case, I would look and see, and this is the 20 to 25 range is a Widowmaker range. I don't know if you're doing them like that, but you'd want to progress that over time. So you take someone who, over the course of 2 years, let's say they're doing a leg press and they've got 5 plates on a side for 20 reps, and they eventually move their way up to doing 9 plates on a side 2 or 3 years later for 20 reps. That's going to manifest in their legs. It's going to be there to some degree. The extent to which it happens is going to be a function of your genetics for muscle growth, how hard you're willing to train, you know, neural adaptations versus muscular adaptations. But as far as knowing like a weak muscle group or looking at soreness and those sorts of things, you can train when you're sore. I've made progress when I've been sore, because I've been sore almost all my life. Probably too much. Yeah, like too much, I think. That's sort of what I'm sort of recognizing, that I should probably be doing less. But if you're not finding over the course of time that some aspect of the performance in the gym is going up, this is just sort of kind of a common sense thing. Regardless of the soreness or not, then why would you expect the muscle to show any adaptation? It's not able to perform any better. And we're trying to increase muscle size. High reps or low reps can both do that. But you want to have demonstrated some form of progressive overload and improved performance capability. So that's where a logbook can come in handy. So you keep doing those sets of 20 to 25 and increase the load you're using by 25%. That's a good way to go. So if you find, so you could do this on yourself, because I think there's a lot of variability here. Do a muscle soreness rating. You know, when you're stretching, you know, 0 to 10, it's like, okay, I'm stretched out my quads. That's about, you know, 10 being like someone's taking a hot poker and they're driving it right through my leg, you know, trying to like sear off the meat of my quads. They're going to barbecue it. That's the most pain I can absolutely imagine in that muscle. And 0 being no pain at all. Rank that yourself. It's like, okay, I went in and I trained with this for this 12-week blast, and my soreness was here consistently. I was pretty sore. I didn't feel like it was debilitating, and I made this amount of gains. You know, I progressed somewhat. I measured my thighs. I got a half an inch or what have you, and then say, okay, so let's say your soreness was 3 or 3 to 4 when you're doing a kind of a warm-up stretch or something. Maybe just rate yourself during the first 5 reps, your first warm-up set. And then say, okay, that's pretty high. Let's just take an example to make it sort of a cleaner way of understanding this. Now I'm going to cut my frequency in half and leave my volume cut my volume in half by cutting my frequency in half. So your workouts are the same. You just train legs only half as often. So instead of 3 times a week, You know, you do it once every 5 days, something like that. And look what, see what happens to your progress on those 20 rep sets, or just in general with the logbook, and see how that fits with your soreness. Like every time I came in, I felt fresh. You know, you, if you dieted down, you know what a flat muscle feels like versus the muscle that's carved up well. The muscle was responsive. It felt full. I was getting a nice pump right from the get-go. That's when I had 5 days rest in between, and my progress went up, and I gained an inch on my thighs during that period of time. That would be like, that's, you know, very, very clear cut. But then, you know, it's like, okay, if I keep on going into the gym where I'm pretty sore, I can still push through anything. Like the, you know, the mind's stronger than body in many cases, but that's not the smartest way to train for muscle growth. I know that if I want, from that little experiment, that would tell you in general that you'd want to have less soreness, feel much more fresh, feel less like the masochist that many of us like to be, because we're OCD with this thing and we want to do everything. We want to leave no stone unturned in terms of increasing muscle mass. It's much more gratifying to have destroyed yourself and then have reaped, you know, these tremendous rewards in terms of size, than to train less and do less than what you know you could have pushed yourself through and gain those size. So that's, we have to sort of trick ourselves psychologically into finding the optimal amount of training volume and frequency, what have you. So in that case, less soreness is connected with more growth. And you can use that then as a mile marker for yourself. It's like, okay, going in the gym, you know, I'm training a little earlier. This is not a smart time to train. I could train. I could push myself through any of these workouts like this. Be a breeze to do overall. But this is not enough recovery for me, given what I figured out when I did that little experiment. So that's a way to kind of do that for oneself. But, and I say this, I'll stop rambling here in a second, but I did a lot of muscle soreness work when I was in grad school. We did a large study for a private company, and muscle damage and muscle soreness is hugely variable. It's all over the place. Some people just get destroyed from the same training bout or exercise injury inducing bout, whereas someone else will basically hardly even know that it happened. And those people would look the same on paper. Their loads would be the same relative to body weight. Like there's nothing you could know of just in basic strength and effort level, demographics, so to speak, to predict that. There are some things that are probably involved, and that's involved with things like the genes for some of the proteins that are involved with the contractile machinery and how well those are held together, because that's where damage occurs to some degree during those bouts. So you kind of have to develop that idea of how sore is the right amount of soreness for yourself, because everyone is so different. At least that's my thought.
Okay, so
everyone's so different.
Your own sort of biofeedback from your own body, I think, is what comes with experience. I think where you have to be fairly intuitive for that when you know when it's not a good idea to train sometimes.
Mm. And you know, the thing too, for people who are really serious and compete, you have to be able to totally switch your mindset. There's lots of things about bodybuilding that are really kind of, they can develop a really unique perspective on what your own mind is doing. So when you're off season, the rule of thumb that I used to have for myself when I'm trying to really gain weight is I should never be hungry, essentially. My food, and I'm always sort of pushing the food down. Whereas when dieting down, you're almost always going to be hungry when you get to those last 4 to 6 weeks. If you're not hungry, then it better have been a cheat meal, or, you know, maybe you're getting sick or something like that, but you're almost always hungry. And those workouts are diabolical. You're just trying to like get in there and create a maintenance stimulus, right, to hold onto the muscle that you hopefully gained in the off season. Whereas if you took that same drive, like I'm going to do this no matter friggin' what, in an off season where you're trying to make gains, chances are you wouldn't be fully recovered in the way you need to be. So there's like this wide range from like the weeks before a show to what is optimal in terms of like, you want to feel good. You want to feel ready. You want to feel like you're indomitable when you go into the gym during the off season to make progress. Whereas the weeks before a show, you know, you're just basically, you're just scraping and crawling to make it to show day. Yeah. So that's the tough thing is like, so when you get used to being sore and doing pre-contest training, that kind of thing, that mindset doesn't necessarily behoove you for how you should feel recovery wise during the off season. So that's why the logbook is a nice thing to look at, because it's objective, it's numbers. And then you can then correlate that or associate that with how you feel your, I have a perceived recovery status scale.
Yeah.
That's in my Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book that I use with all my clients now on check-ins. It helps a lot. Cause they know once they get down to, it's a 0 to 10 scale. Once you get down to like 6 or 7, it's time to take a cruise or deload, step back a little bit. So it creates this, sensitivity to your actual state of recovery. Cause you have to like stop and say, okay, how do I really feel?
How often would you look for someone to do that? Do you think in like an off season setting where someone's looking to try and grow tissue, it's more preferential to try and add those in more frequently, so you've got the body's more rested to grow?
I mean, you could go overboard, you know, and to check in with yourself every hour or something like that. But yeah. I get every week, usually I do weekly check-ins from people. Yeah. But you could probably do it bi-weekly. It depends on how your training is going. So like actually to integrate any earlier question you had, if like, let's say your legs are your weak muscle group, and that's the one you really want to prioritize. You want to make sure that if anything's recovered, like your delts are going to stay big and they look great. Let's say, for example, no matter what, you've got good delts. They grew from the day one, never had a problem adding delt size. Your legs don't want to go. You don't need to check up your PRS, your perceived recovery status scale value, when you go to train delts, because it doesn't really matter. You're not trying to grow them. But you'd want to check maybe at the beginning of the week, after your weekend when hopefully you're recovered, and then before your leg day. Because that's when it most matters. And that would be another thing you could associate or correlate with the soreness on top of that. So, it depends on the person. So some people get really OCD with like gathering so much data, and then they just get lost in a sea of numbers. And then they start sort of mind fucking themselves, and that's not helpful.
Overcomplicating a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of growing, obviously, and adding size on, what's your thoughts on the expression, like people say you can't overtrain, you can only like under-eat, as they say, which like, in my opinion, is a bit of a brash, naive statement to some degree, because the body can only recover from so much.
Yeah, I mean, if you just take it at its word, like, no, obviously, I don't think that's the case. You know, so let's just say, well, then you're just going to train all day long. You're not going to sleep. You're just going to eat and train. Like, you eventually,
the diminishing returns.
Yeah, like that's silly, right? That's absolutely stupid. But obviously the food that you're taking in has an impact on recovery, 100%. So the idea there is that I think that kind of comes from a mistake that many sort of beginners will do, is that they won't eat enough. And so it's an overemphasized point. It's like you're going to need to eat to support all that training you're doing. You want to stay lean, which everyone does, of course. Deep down, no one wants to get fat. Well, maybe some powerlifters do. Some people like just to be as big as possible, and that's, you know, that's no, I got no problem with that. But you need to eat enough to support the recovery, and that is, under eating is a very, very common thing. So that idea, like you just need to eat more and then you won't overtrain, that makes sense. Overtraining is a very difficult thing for people to do. I've done it once, and that was before I ended up really kind of developing fortitude training, and I like absolutely annihilated myself. Did stuff that I don't, you know, I've never seen anyone else do in the gym. Actually, I don't think it was really kind of ridiculous. So,
out of curiosity, then, would you say that most people looking to try and grow underestimate how much they actually need in terms of calorie intake?
A lot of people do. I think some people aren't even estimating. I guess the first thing is they're not even like paying that close attention. That's the first, I eat a lot, but you hear the people, I eat a lot because they have like, a big meal like every day, but the rest of the day they don't eat very much. There's wide variability in the extent to which people's energy expenditure, their non-exercise activity thermogenesis will go up when they add more food in. So some people, you can add 500 calories, and they feel so good, they start cleaning the house more and they take their dog on an extra long walk. And those 500 calories basically get oxidized. They get used up as energy expenditure. And there'll be some metabolic adaptation probably that can go along there too. There are people that literally have to just eat massive amounts of food to gain. And it's, you know, not a pretty or enviable situation. because they've got to eat so much food in order to create some sort of a surplus. Everyone's got a different set point or a settling point, and that's the settling point is kind of a more common term for how people sort of guard against changes in their body weight. We can take the idea and sort of couch it in terms of muscle mass. So some people, because of all the external environmental variables and things that sort of cue them as to what to be doing with their day, when they eat more food, they'll just do more things. They'll go out to the more active, and they'll just burn those calories off. It goes the same way when people are dieting down. So, but most people probably aren't. If you're not literally, one answer is pretty clear, is that if you're not gaining weight, if you could hypnotize yourself or, you know, like lesion your hypothalamus and your appetite control center so that you ate more food and it's just, you know, uncontrollable voracious appetite, you would gain weight. That definitely can happen. They've done that. They do those studies in animals where they just lesion like the ventral lateral hypothalamus, I think, and the animals will just eat continuously until they almost until they kill themselves. So more food will create weight gain. That's absolutely certain. And many people, the limiting factor, this is an important one, I think, is everyone has their comfort zone. So we all have our societal standards for how we want to look. We want to look certain ways. So, you know, if you told someone, here's what you're going to have to do, you're going to look great in 5 years. After the first 6 months of eating, you're going to start to get pretty fat, and you're not going to like how you look. You're going to be that big bloated guy who wears the heavy sweatshirts and long pants in the gym. You're not going to look too much like a bodybuilder. People are going to think you're a strong man or something like that. But once we've done that and we packed on that mass over the course of that time and we bring the weight back down, you're going to look phenomenal. Most people would never do that. It's not, especially now with social media, where we're bombarded with physiques that are just, you know, are just unattainable by most people. We have a sort of perception that, you know, if you're above 10% body fat, then you're just, you know, you're obese and you're out of shape. That's not the old school bodybuilding bulking idea can be too much, like the kind of the power shoving where people would go way beyond what was necessary. So somewhere in between there is where many people will have to perhaps go. But where they'll, if they want to gain more muscle mass. So if they have like a comfort level, it's like, you know what? I've just bought my third set of pants because my waist keeps on getting bigger. I don't feel very comfortable. I'm just going to have to stop and come back. That could be the limiting factor. They just won't eat more because they just don't feel right doing it. Like having some comfort in their life is more important than adding an extra 5 pounds of muscle.
What would be your thoughts on doing maybe shorter cycles then, and to avoid that sort of situation where it's getting too out of hand, doing like, I don't know, say 12 weeks pushing up, like 6 weeks coming down, 12 weeks going up again, and just trying to keep your body fat within a norm, like more human controlled range rather than pushing up too high?
That's a great strategy. It works for lots of people. The thing that I can't say for certain is whether that actually means then doing that you're going to end up at a better end point.
No, I agree with that. I don't think you ever will. It will take you longer to get to where you want to be, I think.
Yeah, it may just slow you down, but it may allow you to ease into that idea of actually getting to that end point amount of muscle mass, because every 12 weeks you die down for a month. It's like, okay, I can do this. I can drop this fat. I know this is going to happen, rather than if you go for 2 years feeling and being fat, relative to where you'd like to be, that's a different scenario than every 3 months checking and saying, you know what, I can drop this fat. I know that if I dieted for another 2 months, I'd be in really good shape. So there's no worries here. It's not like I've fallen into this unrecoverable abyss of obesity that I can't climb out of. You know, I can always diet back down. And so you're reminding yourself of that. And that's, you know, body image is obviously, you know, something that's warped in bodybuilders. It's different. I don't know if it's pathological, probably is according to, you know, the psychologist, but being able to sort of cater to that with dieting down now and again makes total sense. Plus it makes it a little more fun as well. Like literally you can, with many people, if they've been pushing the food, you can just literally drop your food back just to eating at satiety levels where you're not trying to overeat at all. And you'll drop a lot of that water weight, show you kind of what's underneath. And you can drop fat pretty rapidly. I've been the past years ago when I was trying to gain weight, 6,000 calories a day. And that was force feeding, like 6,000 calorie meals. And I could drop back down to 4,000 calories a day. And that was great. That was plenty of food given what I was doing during the day to support my recovery, everything else. That's a 2,000 calorie drop. And I was pretty much stable at 6,000 given everything else. My NEAT probably changed, what have you, but I just created basically something, maybe a 1,000 calorie a day deficit without any impact on my hunger. There's no quote unquote suffering at all in doing that. So you do that, you can do that for 2 or 3 weeks sometimes and drop fat really, really rapidly and readily and sort of reprime your appetite, give yourself a little bit of break. You know, you stepped off on the sidelines of the feeding thing, and then you go back into it and push again to get that memory. Like, yep, I can actually diet down. I'm not going to be fat forever. And then when you start eating again, your appetite tends to be, you got a little break from all that force feeding, which is not a very comfortable thing. So yeah, I think there's utility in that for sure. That's why people are doing it. There's a reason why it's still being used, and it's not just because it's bullshit, I don't think.
No, 100%. That's sort of more the approach I personally take, because I psychologically find it a little bit difficult to get too out of shape, as it were. I just don't feel great. So yeah. For me, I find it more beneficial, even though I know it will take me longer to get where I want to be. I'll enjoy the process a little bit more, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
As I say, it's not about the destination, it's the journey along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and two, it's, I'm as far as the journey goes, the perspective that you gain as well, sometimes we can get, bodybuilding is so self-engrossing. It's such a selfish endeavor in so many ways. And sometimes I've had these sort of mini, sort of epiphanies where it's like, okay, I'm really worried about like all this minutia of like, oh my, you know, do I need to use more probiotics or digestive enzymes, or I'm trying to eat this food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I realized, God, this is such a pitiful thing to be worrying about. There's so much more important things in life. And so being overly engrossed sometimes in those sorts of things and stepping back and seeing the big picture creates perspective. And that's the thing I've like seen so many times when, you know, you're dieting down for a show and like, oh God, I feel awful. And then I realize, man, like, oh, I've chosen to deny myself. It's my choice. Like, I'm in a phenomenal, like, first world situation here where I get to diet down so I can look pretty in my underwear on stage, a bunch of people that I don't know while they judge me. Like, I don't have anything to bitch about. This is great, you know, and I'm doing this on my own. Like, my life's really pure joy. This is not suffering. This is some pain that I've chosen to engage in. So that perspective is something that I think at least I like to think I've carried over into my day-to-day life when I'm not dieting, what have you.
In terms of growing muscle, obviously trying to stay leaner, is something you ever implement with yourself or clients, adding any cardio in during the off-season phase, or even just for health digestive benefits?
If they found that that's the case, or if they really want and have to do cardio, or if they have a very sedentary life otherwise, then I think cardio is helpful. That's something that I learned. Like, it's not really an issue with fortitude training, but something with DC training. I was Dante's sort of official dog crap trainer for many years. So he wasn't really working with clients for a little while. I kind of got burnt out. And one of the things that he had seen that I saw too is he prescribed as part of the program. So I have people doing this cardio on the non-training days, like fasted morning cardio, which is convenient. And that was especially important for people who had like desk jobs. So if those folks didn't do that, their gains in body fat seem to be a little bit worse. Doing some cardio in some cases, you don't want to go too high and create an interference effect, but it can create a bit of an aerobic capacity. So you're just gassing out during the gym. So you can end up being,
when you're adding body weight on as well, it's going to be more of an issue, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, but it's a fine line for different people. Some people can get away with lots of cardio and have no interference effect on their legs, especially, and others, not much at all. Generally speaking, assuming someone's got that taken care of, or that they don't know that they have to do lots of activity for heart health for some reason, not necessarily a gigantic improvement, at least in the relative risk of myocardial infarction or all-cause mortality by becoming super fit. There's some advantage there, but mainly the the greatest health benefits just comes from getting out of the kind of couch potato range. This is epidemiologically speaking. So if you're weight training and you don't spend the rest of your day, you know, sitting on the couch, you're probably doing most of what you can do activity wise to improve your cardiovascular risk factors. So not that there can't be other things that could be done. So otherwise, then I would have people try to do as much weight training as they possibly can. So I just, he may even listen to this. There's a guy I just had a consult with not long ago, and he'd been doing cardio, trying to gain weight, trying to gain leg size. And I suggested, let's see what happens when one option you can do is remove the cardio that you're doing. And then instead of that, move up a volume tier in fortitude training. And I want to have you training as much as you possibly can with weights and creating that as much energy expenditure there, which isn't tremendous actually during the workouts, although it can be pretty high, but you can get a pretty substantial epoch from hard training. And that people find this all the time. I tell people when they start fortitude training for the first time, keep their diet as much as they can the same way and just see what happens with the training. And I can't think of a time where they didn't start to lose weight and lean up if they didn't adjust their food upwards. So something about the training, it may be the frequency, maybe that I've created the set types in fortitude training so that
intensity.
Using them properly, you have to train hard. Yeah, you just have to. And it's the hard training really which creates that epoch. It's, you know, the wimpy training will not get that done.
Do you think like deep tissue, and obviously you said you're training acupuncture now as well. Do you think those sort of therapy treatments help in terms of muscle building? Because it allows obviously for increased blood flow through the tissue.
I haven't seen a study, but yeah, in many people, I'm horrible. I'm like a typical doctor who doesn't take care of himself. I don't get massages or those sort of things the way I should. The stretching, I think, is one thing that seems to help to some degree, just being flexible. At least that's a whole other rabbit hole to go down. But yeah, without a doubt, there's recuperative or regenerative effects of a massage and deep tissue done in the right amount as well. So you can go overboard with anything. And, you know, if you get a practitioner, and I've, you know, had a lot of body work when I was in grad school, interviewed massage therapists for my gym. It was a holistic health club. So we had some massage therapists there. And so I've had some really good, I've had some really bad massage therapists. And so finding someone who's good, who knows the person, who comes to know the person's body, recognizes what is too much and what is not enough for that person is what's important. So if you have someone who just goes hog wild, and this can happen, and they do a lot of heavy, deep tissue, disruptive massage, let's say it's on the legs the day before you train legs, that's probably going to have a negative effect. So that's not good. That's not a way to get that done. But if you have someone who knows, you know, can read the person very well subjectively in terms of their pain and discomfort and apply the therapy in the right way, absolutely, yes. So there's a little bit of massage data suggesting it reduce muscle soreness and those sorts of things. So it has some recuperative abilities. So
one last question, I don't want to keep you too long, Scott. So in terms of the grander scheme of things of building muscle, is there any take home tips in terms of keeping injury free and long-term sustainability of training? Because obviously if you get injured, you're going to go backwards in a big fashion for a while.
One of the things that I put into fortitude training intentionally, and part of this was because I created in part for myself, is auto-regulating your exercise selection. So one of the set types, you basically rotate through standard groupings of exercises. So you come back to those exercises every 3 weeks and you hit the same ones. So if it's, you know, your leg press day, it's your leg press day. And you're supposed to do that and log it and try to progress. But even then, don't be stupid. So the bottom line is, you can use this as the soundbite. Don't be stupid in the exercise selection. If you're doing leg presses, or people have done this with squats for years and they end up ruining squats. They say, I have to squat, and their knees are killing them and their low back's killing them. And they're basically incurring a chronic overuse injury from that movement plane or that movement pattern. Avoid that. And just literally, I mean, there'll be times when I go into the gym and I have to try 3 or 4 exercises until I find one that works. And I've been able to do that. And I mean, not that I'm injury free, I've got plenty of injuries, but the thing that I've heard from lots of people who've taken on fortitude training is that their aches and pains, you know, their kind of chronic tendonitis, arthritis, those sorts of things get diminished, because rather than coming in and doing those exercises you feel like they have to do, the part of the program, this is mandated in the program, especially during the pump sets and the muscle rounds, is if you sit down and it doesn't feel right, particular exercise, you just don't do it. Like that's what you're supposed to do. You don't do that exercise. You pick one that feels right. And part of that is for injury prevention. So, you know, if you go to do like an incline press, it's like, oh my God, my biceps tendons are, they feel like they're going to just snap here. I'm getting some impingement. Then you don't do that. You pick another exercise that may even target the same area, but just doesn't cause that pain. Or part of the reason for that in fortitude training too, is that you're auto-regulating your exercise selection based on the biofeedback you get from where the muscle is sore or tender. So you could even be blind. If someone could hypnotize you and not have told you that you'd done two incline chest movements that week, and you come in for your third chest workout that day, you would sit down and say, you just like to do incline chest. Everyone needs more upper chest, right? But if you sit down and you say, wow, that's really, there's no point in training that. That's just sore as shit. You do something else. So that rotates the stimulus around. So you don't retarget the same aspects of the tissue with the same types of movements. And activation patterns are different for different exercises, even though biomechanically they might both be creating horizontal shoulder abduction or elbow flexion or what have you. Not all curls are created equally. Not all compound leg press machines are created equally. They all will create different activation patterns. So you want to avoid those that really you can tell you're sore on, and then avoid those that you can tell are going to exacerbate some sort of a chronic inflammation you've got. And that's just been a total lifesaver, because you go for like months being an idiot like I have done for decades.
Join the team.
You're doing the same thing, yeah. And eventually you just grind yourself. Okay, now I can't do any pressing. Now I'm totally screwed, and I got to go get fixed or fix myself. Whereas it's like, nope, I'm not going to do that. And there's no incline press happening today. You just avoided what would have been months of slowly grinding that movement pattern and creating an increasing staircase of inflammation workout after workout. So you just constantly sort of avoid the landmines that may be looming ahead of you in terms of chronic overuse injury. And that works just tremendously. But you have to be disciplined in a way, just like we've kind of talked about, where in the off season you want to feel good when you go in to train. You shouldn't feel run down like you are pre-contest. It's hardcore to go in there. I'm going to friggin' incline press until the wheels fall off, because that's what I know I need to get upper chest development. Well, yeah, but if you can't incline press at all because you've got chronic overuse and that movement plane, well, then you're screwed. So you have to step back and be a smart trainer and literally be disciplined in terms of the intelligence that you apply to the training, as much as being someone who's willing to train hard. And I think that's helped a lot of, it's helped a lot of the older guys and women who've come into fortitude training, clear up injuries. Like they have these chronic overuse injuries and they just kind of go away because they stopped doing those things that were perpetuating those injuries and maybe even leading to like literally an overt injury, like a tendon snap or something like that. So that's a big tip.
That's the one thing I say to everyone, is just like use your brain and just think about what you're doing, because if anything feels a little bit off or hurts at all, you probably shouldn't be doing it. And just like for me now, if I find anything which just doesn't quite feel right, I'll just move on and do another exercise.
Smart. Yeah, absolutely, man. No point in that.
Absolute pleasure today then, Scott. We'll wrap that up there. So there's a huge amount of knowledge in a very short period of time there. Really appreciate that. And I'm sure it will help loads of those people to hopefully add lots of muscle tissue over the next few winter months. I'm sure everyone goes into hibernation mode trying to pack on decent pounds of tissue.
There you go.
So for anyone who doesn't know who you are, Scott, how can people find you and find you on social media, your websites, check out your new bodybuilding books out?
Yeah, you can go to byobbcoach.com. That stands for Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach.com. You just Google Stevenson bodybuilding, it comes right up. For the people in the UK, you're going to be there, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I'll be in Edinburgh. It's the last weekend of November. If you go to traperformance.com, you can buy tickets there. They've only got tickets, I think, for the second day. It's kind of a two-day seminar. The second day I'm covering a variety of topics, but love to see people there. And that'll be lots of Q&A and those sorts of things too. So people can see me if they want to in person there, Scotland. I'll be back again, promise.
Awesome, man. So I'm very, very much looking forward to seeing you there at the seminar. And again, thank you so much for the podcast this afternoon.
You're welcome, Charlie.